Now it's time to be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist, Joey B. has researched grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B. Outdoor Science and Nature. Man, do I have the coolest job. I travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. The title of today's show is Organic Plant Trials and Experiments. And there is no one better to bring on board as my guest, Inspector Dave. Inspector Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joey B. Always a pleasure to chat with you and share our knowledge with your fans.
Well, you know, it's funny, Inspector Dave. Again, I always look to you when it comes time for the organic garden and the questions we have. And you always say the garden is an ongoing experiment. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that every year something different is happening that controls the outcome of your garden. The weather is different every year. There's variations. You know, some years are wet, some are dry, some are hot, some are cool. Some years there's more critters around, less critters. Different type of seeds become available or not available. Different type of plants become available or not available, or disease problems. So there's always a lot of variables going on when you get into gardening.
You know, it's funny that you said different seeds and plants are not available. And you and I were chatting recently, and the Tan Veracruz, the pepper that I love to jar, is not available at Cross Country Nurseries right now. So I was looking up, and there are some seeds available, and growing things from seeds makes me happy anyway. But you are correct when you're saying that. Now, I also know that you keep a journal about your garden. Is this, because we always talk about gardening tools, is this a helpful tool?
It's just like running a laboratory experiment. You keep a journal of what you're doing, or a little notebook with all your notes, so you can recreate the experiment if it went well, or if it did not go well, then you know where you can make changes. And as we garden from year to year, and I've been gardening, you know, 35, 40 years now, things start to run together. Like, was last year the year that that grew well, or was it the year before, and what happened to weather? So it's a way just to document everything that's going on in your garden as our memories start to either get a little muddled sometimes because there's so much in them, just like a computer, our database gets overloaded. So it's just a way to have something, especially in the winter when we're putting our orders together and planting the garden, looking out the window because it's too cold to play in the garden, and getting it all planned. It just gives us notes like, okay, yeah, let's try this year. It worked out really well for the last couple of years.
Well, you know what? As I moved on to the farm this year and started with the raised bed garden, I actually started a whole new journal because it's a new adventure with a different climate, different amount of sun. And so for me, again, it was a help and will be a helpful tool to me. Now, we're talking about different experiments and trials in your garden. You have been using green sand for a while. So what is green sand and why do you use it?
Well, green sand comes from deposits near the ocean, from marine deposits. And it's just old, basically composted critters from the sea, all the different shells and lobsters and whatever else was in that particular area. And it's mined, you know, by companies, and then they put it in bags. And the idea of green sand is it has a lot of different trace minerals and things that you won't find in general products that you have for your garden. And this is a soil amendment that builds up the health of your soil. It's not a fertilizer as you think it as a fertilizer, because green sand takes a year or 2 years to actually break down the nutrients to make them available to the plants. But it does work right away to start breaking up the soil. If you have really compacted or heavy clay type soils, it helps to break that up and loosen it up so the water and the air can get in. And if you have sandy soils, it can also work to help control the moisture and bring some moisture into that sandy soil so it doesn't all drain away quickly. So it's really, it's a soil amendment that it breaks down and helps the soil get a better tilth, they call it, and just has a better quality to it for the roots to go through and all that. But don't think of it as just a fertilizer, because it's not, but it will provide many, many nutrients that are especially good for tomatoes. I've noticed a really good increase on those because the type of trace minerals that are in there, and there's 50, 60 different trace elements, too many to talk about, but it's got a lot of those nutrients in there that become available to the plant. So it's going to be a couple of years of use of that before you see like the really good maximum benefits. I've been using that for like, I don't know, 15, 20, 25 years. So I just take a bag or two and rototillate in every year. It's how I amend the soil with that.
Well, and again, you use the word trace. And for those who are rookie gardeners, trace means in small amounts. So there's certain minerals that you might not get in a conventional fertilizer that the green sand is going to provide. And a fun story is, because again, having moved up here, looking for green sand, call the local nursery, and the nurseryman thought I was joking. I said, do you sell green sand? And he's going, what do you want, blue sand? I said, no, green sand. And he had no clue as to what it was, and I had to educate him about green sand. He then at the very end, he apologized, said, hey, look, I just learned something new. Don't know if he was bringing it in. I found it at another local nursery, purchased it over there, but I just thought that was a fun story that goes along with that.
Right. Now, and that's where you want to find it locally too. You can educate your local gardeners because it's an organic product too. So any of your organic friends that are growing, and it's good, not just for vegetables, it's good for flower gardens also, you know, to put into any soil, anything that's growing, you know, it helps. And it's heavy to ship. I mean, you can find it online, you can find little bags of it, but it costs a lot of money with the shipping and all that. So if you can talk one of your local suppliers into stockpiling that in their inventory and then send some of your gardening friends there to make it worth their time, then you'll make sure you always have a steady supply of it.
No, and that's a good point too, because when you want something, you want to be able to go to whatever, Nursery X and a local, because we want to support our locals and make sure it's there. And that's actually a very good point. Now, over time, you've changed varieties of seeds as the years have gone by. For example, let's talk corn and then we'll talk cucumbers. Like, why have you changed your varieties?
Well, again, this goes back to the experiment thing in our notebook. We try different varieties as they come out. Some are newer varieties that are like brand new to the market. Some have been out for a few years, and some are heirloom type varieties. So as you experiment and keep track, I found that corn, I love to grow corn. I grow a bicolor super sweet corn, synergistic corn actually. And the thing about it is that the soil here can stay cool later in the season. So the sooner you get your corn into the ground, the sooner you can have corn to eat. So the particular variety that I grow is a bicolor that germinates well in cool soil, whereas a lot of corns need very warm soil to germinate, or people treat them, which we never want to do that. So it's an untreated seed that tolerates cool soil. So I can plant it very early in May and not just have, was it knee high by July 4th? I can have it chest high by July 4th by getting an early start. So it just really works well, close to 100% germination. So I'm not like wasting seed or planting multiple times. I just get it as soon as it goes in the ground. I know how to space it. Each one's going to pop and it's going to grow, and I'm going to get 1 or 2 years of terrific corn off of that.
And tell me about your cucumbers, because I know you changed those varieties, the variety of seeds over the years.
Right. Cucumbers, the same thing. I experimented with many different types of cucumbers. And when you're looking at in your seed catalogs like at corn and cucumbers, there's like dozens and dozens of varieties to choose from. And it can really make your head spin, like, oh, which one's best? Like, you keep reading it. And I'm in awe of the people that write the seed magazines. Like, how can you write up 20 types of corn and each one sound as good as the other one? It's just an amazing use of vocabulary and words and descriptions. So now you have to sort through all that sales jargon, so to speak, that's in there, and really find out for yourself what works the best. And the cucumbers, I had a number of issues. I like to trellis mine, so they grow up on a trellis so that they don't use up as much ground space. Helps with disease, helps with insect control, and it helps keep the cucumbers straight. They don't rot because they're on the ground. So I went through a couple different varieties of cucumbers over the years, looking at commercial grades for farmers markets because they're very productive. And I found a couple of years ago, it's called a diva cucumber. And this is an all-female flowered cucumber that comes out of the Middle East. And it's a really unusual type of cucumber because it doesn't require pollination. So you can grow it in a greenhouse even. because you don't need bees to go from flower to flower. It grows and looks like a regular cucumber plant. It gets the yellow flowers on it, and the same insects will attack it if you have pests going. But you don't need any bees in there. The bees will still go over there, but somehow they self-pollinate, and they're just so productive. They're burpless. They're super thin skin. There's no seeds in them, and they're just incredibly. I can go out at night and look at everything, and I go out the next morning, and there's like 12 of them to pick. And then I go out the next night, oh, maybe tomorrow will be some more. Next morning, it's like 12 more to pick. It's just incredible productivity out of these diva. They're a little expensive to buy, but I'm buying small amounts. So just little seed packets, you get 20 or 30 seeds in there. Unbelievable. And disease resistance is just really terrific on them too. And they'll keep producing, you know, well into the season.
It's funny that you're mentioning the divas. I remember a few years ago, probably about 2 years ago, in your garden, as you're mentioning, it's like I'd be over there in the morning and pick 10 cucumbers with you. And at nighttime, you're going, I got 10 more. And I'm going, what? And like in a 12, 15 hour period, it just set fruit and it just went again. It was pretty, they are amazing. But I guess my question to you was, why do you change the varieties? And this is the answer is you're looking for things like this and you're only going to find it by experimentation. And that's really what the title of the show is about. And I happen to know that one of your favorite things to eat are sugar snap peas. So sugar snap peas, tell me a little bit about what's going on in your garden with that.
Well, sugar snap peas, for those of you who want to have an early crop and can't wait to get gardening and when the gardening season starts, sugar snap peas are the first thing you put in, besides maybe some lettuce or some arugula. But sugar snap peas are just the most incredible thing that's ever been invented back, 40 or 50 years ago when they first hybrided it. It was a cross between peas and string beans. And they, for those of you who have never had them, also snow peas, like that you get like in Asian food and all that, the snow pea pods. It's all like a cross between them. So it looks like a bean, smells like a pea, and tastes like incredible. They're super sweet. And there's a lot of varieties now. They've done a lot of different versions now since the original sugar snaps, which are like 6 foot tall, which I grew probably at the old house. I was there probably 30 or 35 years ago. I was growing the 6 foot sugar snap peas. So now they've come out with a lot of new versions that are dwarf plants. They only maybe 24, 36 inches tall. So you don't need to have big trellising. You can grow them in smaller space. They're kind of bushy. They have stringless ones now. So you can just pick them right off the vine and eat them right in the garden because they're just so sweet. And you can eat them raw. You can freeze them. You can stir fry them. I could just eat a pound of them out of the garden every day if I was trying to get that productivity. So I've been changing up this year a little bit, because productivity was down for the last year or two. So I'm going to do an extensive rotation of a space that I grow them in. And I'm going to try a couple new varieties that I haven't grown in. Not new, but varieties I haven't grown in a few years. I'm going to go back to the original ones I grew and try to get my bounty back up again, because it's been a little low for the last year or two. So I'm looking forward to that. I just finished up the other day ordering up from a couple different seed catalogs so I can get the varieties that I want. So it's Sugar Daddy and Sugar Bon and Snack Hero are going to be the front runners this year.
Great marketable names, too, for all of them, without a doubt. Now, here's one thing. Going into your organic garden over the past couple of years, I noticed that you grow more cherry tomatoes than you have for many years. So why'd you make that change?
Well, basically because I'm impatient. I don't want to wait for like big beefy tomatoes to grow because they take a lot longer to grow. And you're sitting there waiting and hoping that a bird doesn't peck at it or it doesn't get disease or it doesn't get damaged in a storm, doesn't fall off. So the cherry tomatoes, they come by the thousands off my vines. And the vines are indeterminate, which means they're going to keep growing forever, basically, until the frost takes them out. So once my cherry tomatoes start to appear, usually in July, they'll start to ripen up. Then it's just nonstop, you know, right through the final killing frost there. So there's no interruption, really, in my cherry. And I grow three different types. I grow like an orange, a red, and a yellow. So, and sometimes like a brown one, I'll mix them up, and they're just pretty in a stout. Each one has a unique little flavor to it. And then they just add a lot of visual appeal to any garden sour that you're making, whether it's for you or for the neighbors, if you're giving them away. And I just like them. And a lot of them have a good disease resistant package now, and they grow so fast that the plant can tolerate, you know, pest damage or storm damage, because it just keeps on growing, you know, like Jack and a Beanstalk, just keeps going.
Well, you mentioned the term indeterminate, and there's determinate tomatoes. So for somebody who's a rookie gardener, can you describe that difference with tomatoes?
Well, determinate, it's like it implies it's a determined type height or growth pattern or that it's going to get to. And there'll be more of a bushy type tomato. And they're good when you have small space and maybe a patio you're going to grow on, or you're going to grow in pots, determinate varieties. And they grow just to a certain size, and they put all their fruit out kind of around the same time. They rush to get done. So it's you get all your bulk at once, whereas the indeterminate is indetermined. So it's going to keep growing, and you're just going to keep setting fruit, you know, till the cows come home, basically. So that's the two difference between the two. If you have space, do indeterminate. If you don't have a lot of space, do determinate, or do both.
That's a great answer. Yeah, I like that too. That's a great answer. How long have you been composting, and does this really help the amendments in the soil?
Well, yes, composting is very important for a garden, because it's one of those things you can do on a local level. And composting, just to review, is grass from your lawn that's untreated, leaves, and all your vegetable scrapings that you have from the kitchen, you know, when you're peeling potatoes and coring apples and everything else. So you're putting all that into a pile in the back, whether you have a bin or a roller or a homemade thing, whatever way you're composting. But you're, instead of all that bulk going down to a landfill somewhere or to an incinerator, where it's all that's just being wasted, all the nutrients and the energy that's in that those cast-offs, they're being recycled back onto your property. So you're putting them into the compost bin, you're breaking them down so any diseases burned off in there with the heat of the pile, and then you're incorporating that into your soil of your garden, whether it's vegetables or flowers, and you're putting a lot of nutrients back into the garden for free. Basically, it's all things that you would have just thrown away, and now you're reusing them. And it's like we benefit from a diet that's very diversified. Same thing here. You're making a diversified diet for your garden, because you can put all kinds of stuff into the compost pile. So your soil will be very happy that you're giving it all these different nutrients for the worms and the microbes that are in there. And they, in turn, will help to benefit the plants to grow that much better, too. So composting is cheapest, easiest thing to do, and really, there's no reason not to compost unless you just don't have any space whatsoever. But you can do small composting too. Some of the cities now, I think, are starting composting areas where they want you to segregate your clippings and all that from the and scrapings from the kitchen and put them in separate barrels, and they're going to take them somewhere and to a compost site and then recycle them, and then I guess make the compost available back to people or use it in the parks.
I noticed as you're describing that in the cities, there was a gentleman who started to compost, and on his bike, he started to ride and share, and he created a business of composting. So people would actually, like you're saying, they would put out their scraps, he would pick them up, he would compost them, and then redeliver them back to the people as, you know, the finished product, which is just, I guess, innovative, really neat. And again, especially inside the city, when you talk about becoming environmental friendly, that's just a great way of doing it. Now, the next thing with trials and experiments, tell me about the development of you using rain barrels. When did you start this process? And tell me, like, I guess, from when you started it through today.
Well, rain barrels is another one of those things I started very early in my gardening career. So it's, you know, 35, 40 years ago that I got my first pickle barrel, which I still have, believe it or not. The older barrels were much more durable than the newer ones that we find around. But we catch rainwater off of the house through the gutter system, and we store it in the barrels. We keep a mosquito net over the top so we don't get mosquitoes or algae growing in there. And then we use that water in the garden. And back then I was just had little sprinkler cans. I had the barrel up on a couple of cinder blocks and a little spigot on the bottom, and or I would dip the top, and I would just take out the sprinkler can, you know, 1 by 1 gallon at a time, and water the garden with it. Very time consuming, but I was using good rainwater. And the idea with rainwater versus city water, or even well water, you know, that you have on a property, which is expensive to pump, is that it's free. And it's also doesn't have any chemicals in it, other than maybe what may come out of the air, you know, for pollution and all that. But for the most part, it's not treated water. So there's no chlorine in it or bromine or any other things in there that add a lot of salts to the soil, because you don't want to get a salt buildup in your soil, because that's detrimental to the soil health for the plants and all that. So the idea is that the rain barrels, you're using that water, you know, in the garden, and it's as close as you can get to like natural water, so to speak, there. So the plants really like it. It's pH neutral, so it works out really well. And then as I started realizing, like, there's got to be more I can do with this rainwater, and I just stumbled across a drip irrigation system that uses Tyvek hosing, and it's like a little weep line, and it works off a gravity barrel, so it doesn't require any city pressure. It only needs 3 to 5 pounds of pressure, which I can get by putting my barrels up on racks that I built. And that water will then ooze out of these tapes, and they're underground. They're down a couple inches in each garden row, and they just make the plants, the soil moist, you know, by weeping this whole time. And it's, I catch the water from the house, pump it out there, and then the barrels just, you know, weep, you know, through these lines there. Great stuff. Comes out of a Canadian company, Irrigrow. I was just talking to a fellow yesterday, in fact, a little mom and pop family type organization. He works for them, been with them for 30 years or more. And they are really doing quite a bit, you know, with growers. And some of the newer growers, there's a new market that's developed for them with the indoor greenhouses, that where they're growing a lot of recreational plants, shall we say. That's becoming a big market for them, because they found out that it's good for the type of, it's not hydroponic type growing, you know, water growing, it's soil growing. People that are growing in soil in greenhouses and hothouses, this system's working out really well for them.
Now, I noticed in your garden, you plant corn a few times during the same growing season. Why would you do this?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the type of corn I grow requires isolation. And in terms that it can't be near other types of corn, there's several types of corn, and the corns have to pollinate through wind action, because there's like clouds of pollen that come off every corn plant. And you need to have, with certain varieties, if you don't isolate your corn by a mile or more from other types of corn, it can cross-pollinate, and it may just become pig corn, or won't be very tasty corn. So what I do is I isolate my corn, and I do that by, there's a one fellow in the neighborhood that also grows corn. So I buy him his corn. So we plant the same corn each year. So our corns are isolated in the sense that they're both the same variety. So they'll feed off each other if the bees get back and forth between them or the wind. And then I plant mine in small blocks, like blocks of like 10 or 12 seeds at a time, to spread out the harvest, first of all, because I don't want all my corn to come in at once, because I like to eat it fresh. I don't like to freeze it or give it away too much because it's so good. And then this staggers that harvest. Also, I take advantage of maybe hitting an extra good window of weather for growing, whether it's the water that's at time or the heat or whatever. So I have a good chance that if for some reason one little patch doesn't grow well, then I know the next patch is going to grow a little bit better, and next patch after that. So I can start planting as soon as the ground is warmed up. The soil that I use with the seed has to be like over 45 degrees on the soil thermometer. And then I can continue to plant, and I'll plant right through August. And in August, that plant that I, those seeds that I planted will come due, you know, before the first frost. So I have corn over an extended period of time by doing that.
I think that's absolutely a great idea, because as you said, people will get this huge harvest of corn where they just can't handle all the corn they're growing, where you can eat what's there, and a few weeks later, another block is ripe, et cetera, and goes on. And this show was brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or at one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to RamseyOutdoor.com. Now, what typically borders your garden are these Mexican sunflowers. Why do you grow them?
Well, Mexican sunflowers, also called Thitonia, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's Thitotoni. And I find that from pine tree garden seeds. It's the only catalog I've found right now, pine tree garden seeds. They operate under superseeds.com on the internet. And I used to always grow sunflowers because they're pretty to grow and the birds like them and the bees like coming around and they're photogenic and they bring pollinators in. There's a lot of reasons to grow sunflowers. But some of the sunflowers, the big giant heads, they were disappointing to me. They would fall over in a storm or they just wouldn't germinate properly. So I stumbled across these one time and I tried them probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. And it's not a sunflower like you think, like a big yellow thing. These come in orange, or and then they have a yellow variety, but the orange variety grows much better. And it grows, it's the tiniest little sunflower seed, not typical like you see in a bird feeder or whatever, big giant seeds, but tiny little seeds. And I direct sow them right in the garden, and then they sprout, and then they kind of hang out there for a little while. They're little. Next thing you know, they start to grow. And by the time they're done, you can get a stalk that's probably an inch or 2 inches around, like a tree almost, like a little tree. And they grow into these massive bushes, and they just get hundreds of flowers on them. And the butterflies, the bees, the hummingbirds, all the pollinators, they just cover these flowers because they're so attractive to bring in. They have a very unique type of pollination area on there where the bees get in there and all that. So it's I like it for that. And then they're just fun to look at. They're so big because I put them on the border of the garden so they're not interfering with what's growing. And even my beekeeper, he's been watching them for the last couple of years. He's going to start growing them this year. Community garden, they grow them. And then we have a butterfly garden in town and they grow them there also. And it's just a kind of one of those not like well-discovered or well-talked about things, but look for Mexican sunflowers if you want to just have a little spot, a little tiny package. You only need to put a few of them in and then put a stake or something there for in case you get a heavy windstorm so they don't break over in the way. But they just grow and they'll grow again right to the frost. They'll just keep going and going and going.
You mentioned about superseeds.com. If you're going to give just a few names of a couple companies you personally like, can you throw a few different companies? Well, again, we don't get any money from them, just to help people out.
Territorialseeds.com, Territorial Seeds. They're out west, I think, Washington State, somewhere out that way. Vermont Bean Seed Company. They're really good, too. They're not in Vermont, but that's the name of the company, Vermont Bean Seed Company. They're really good. And then the Pine Tree Garden Seeds, they're up out of Maine. That's a nice local seed supplier I like to deal with up there. Real nice people to deal with, real family-oriented type place. So Pine Tree Garden Seeds, which is Super Seeds, is how they're listed. So either way, you can find them on there. So I've been finding them the best. And then for plants and all that, your friend chiliplants.com, I guess, would be the proper website for plants and seeds.
Yeah, no, those are, again, and thank you. Those are great sites. And for those people out there, and you know, this, it doesn't even have to be a rookie because we're always looking for something new. And that's the experiment and trials we're talking about today. There's always something new. And I also mentioned this a few times that when you get these seed catalogs, after you use them, pass them on to a kid because kids are so amazed. Like they'll open up because as far as they're concerned, there's a tomato and all of a sudden there's five pages of tomatoes. And then they're looking at the beans and there's five pages of beans. And it sort of opens their eyes to really what's out there and what's available. And again, it may just generate the interest in a child where they then want to have a little family garden or their own little garden and get them rolling on it as well. Now,
right. Yes, they're good too. And, you know, just to interject another company too is GardensAlive.com. And GardensAlive.com, I've been with them since like 1982. And they were one of the forefront companies in terms of organics. They were, did have very tiny catalog when they first started out and getting into organic fertilizers, both for the lawn, you know, and for the gardens. And then they started getting into household products that were safe and then more fertilizers and they sold seed for a while, but they were one of the front runners when it came to organics. So I've stayed with them for a number of years, still do. I order from every year, They have a garden club you can join, so you can get good discounts and free shipping on everything. But gardensalive.com, you know, check them out too for all your supplies that you may need to buy that you can't find locally.
No, that is a great company. I've ordered many times from them. So in your garden, do you rotate your crops? And if so, why?
Crop rotation is important, and it's a little hard in smaller gardens because you just don't have enough space. Like farmers, they have acres of fields. Like, okay, in the lower field, it's going to be corn, and in the upper field, it's going to be wheat, and in the other corn, it's going to be clover, and they can rotate, you know, very big areas. So in a small garden, it's a little bit more of a challenge, but I do the best we can to rotate from area to area, and they do that for a few reasons. First, some of the plants use certain nutrients in the garden more heavily than other plants. So the soil may get depleted of that particular nutrient in that garden row. So that's if you go next year and put them somewhere else, and that bed will rebalance back out again. And for disease, a lot of your disease is soil borne that you found on plants. So if you can keep moving your plants away from diseases that are coming out of the soil, and it's very hard to get rid of those diseases in the soil. They just exist there year after year. Some years are more susceptible than others. Some plants are more susceptible. So it gives you a chance to kind of beat the disease a little bit. And then for pest control, because some of your pests will overwinter in the garden. The eggs and stuff will be down there. So by moving your plants around, if it's a plant that's particularly aggressive, let's say to a cucumber beetle, you know, if you can move your cucumbers to the other side of the garden, you got a chance maybe that you can, you know, just trick them a little bit so they won't come back up and eat your seedlings and all that. So crop rotation is that thing for soil depletion, disease, and insect control, the three biggies.
And yeah, and it does work for the three big ones for sure. So for someone who's thinking about gardening for the very first time next year, and again, with all that's going on in our country and people staying a little bit closer to home, and last year was throughout the country, many brand new gardeners out there. Are there any vegetables that's difficult to grow, or a simple hint for that rookie gardener?
Well, the simple hint is don't buy everything in the catalog. it's very easy to get that initial excitement going, and the pictures and descriptions. You just want to buy one of everything. So the best thing is to start small with your garden and work your way up as your experience and your time and your back can stand it. And look for plants or seeds that maybe have each catalog has different things that are indicators. Like it may say kid friendly. So something that's like kid friendly means it's quick to mature, easy to grow. So because kids have a shorter attention span, but so do adults. You know, we're limited on our time and all that too. So you want to grow things that are very easy to grow to get started, and try to avoid anything that has a long growing period, like 100 days or more. If it says like over 100 days, then chances are you're going to get really impatient waiting for it to grow. You have a better chance of disease, a better chance of storm damage, critter damage. So the faster maturing varieties of plants and seeds under 100 days are where you should put your focus. Things like Brussels sprouts, they can be fussy to grow. Melons, they take a long time to grow. Those are just a few of the things there. And spacing, too. Look and see how much space they say I need for that. Look for compact varieties, as if it says trailing variety or aggressive variety. Like aggressive means that it's going to take over half of your yard. You know, you don't want to like just have, like pumpkins can be very aggressive in their format when they grow. So if you decide you're going to put in a couple of pumpkins, it might be not a good use of the space that you have there, because they're going to just invade everywhere.
Now, what about, I guess, for the first time gardener, soil prep? Is there anything that they should do in, you know, they're prepping their soil? Again, it might be a small little area. What would you suggest there?
Well, soil prep never ends. It should really start in the fall when you're planning out where your garden's going to go. You can start to loosen up soil and all that. The main thing with getting in there is, again, watching your enthusiasm. Wait till the soil is dry enough to work. And that means you pick up a clump of soil, hold it in your hand, and it should squeeze out and crumble like a sponge. If it's like it's all clayey and sticks, and you can make like a baseball out of it, it's too wet. Do not go in there. You're going to wreck the soil, and you won't be able to ever recover from that damage that you do to the soil's tilth. because it'll just drive all the air out. So make sure the soil's dry enough, and then you just want to amend it. Some of the things we talked about, putting compost in there, maybe some organic fertilizers. And that's why it's good to put a lot of the organic fertilizers. I like to do them in the fall. Things that are going to bring the pH up. Most of our soil is acid, so we want to bring the pH up a little bit. And then also bringing in the nutrients to give them a chance to break down over the winter. And then it helps the frost heaves and the snow that may melt on there, or the rains that you get, you know, depending on what area of the country you got. So it'll just help that whole soil start to build up its nutrients and get its balance. The worms will find their way around, and everything will be ready to go when you're going to plant. But getting, whether you're going to rototill, there's a couple different ways you can do. Some people do no dig methods. Some do layering lasagna methods. That's a whole nother discussion, but there, you have to decide what type of garden you're going to do. Definitely you're going to do organic. I don't want anybody using chemicals on the garden. That's not what growing good, healthy vegetables is all about. And when do organics, you know, whether it's through compost or organically approved products, make sure they have the seal of approval on them from the organic group. So those are the things I would recommend.
And if I could just throw one more in there, if they ever want to test their soil, there are universities, for example, I'm bragging because I'm a Rutgers grad, but the Rutgers Extension, you can, for a minimal cost, they will give you an analysis of your soil. So for the first timers, and again, that's also a learning process to them too, is to what is inside their soil and what their soils may be lacking. And every major university has an extension. There is at least one in every single state. So they can actually have their soil tested as well.
Yeah. pH is very important. I never used to really track my pH. And then a few years ago, I was really reading up on all that. And I bought myself a tester, a soil tester, so I can do it myself. But your soils for vegetable growing, you want to stay a little bit on the acidic side. 6.2 to 6.7 is the range they generally recommend. Tomatoes being a little more acidic soil, closer to 6.2. But if you get yourself into that range, then you can be assured that the plants will thrive well. They'll be able to take up the nutrients as they need to, and the plants will be able to put roots down and use the water and everything else available too. So pH is very important. And that's something you can start doing in the fall over the winter time, starting getting your pH adjusted so it's ready to go. It takes time to adjust your pH, so it gives it time to adjust by the springtime.
Well, Inspector Dave, as usual, I have learned so much from you, and I'm sure the listening audience, we are international, so there are people in Belgium right now listening to this show, and in a week or so, they'll be listening to you there as well. So I just want to thank you so much for everything you've done to educate our public about organic gardening.
Okay, thanks very much for having me, for having this forum where we can share our information and our experiences with everyone.
Again, thank you. And until next time, enjoy life's adventures.
You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free, and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures.